Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review. Sometimes I have guests on, Juliana mostly, but today, special guest, Jesse Willis. Hi, Jesse.
Hey, Luke. How are you doing?
From the Science Fiction... No, SFF Audio. What's this? Yes,
science. Yep.
Science
doesn't
fiction
stand for anything.
It doesn't. It's just the name is what it is. Yeah. So SFF Audio, and I invited you on mainly because we were playing computer games, and then the computer games stopped working. I was like, well, I'm going to be recording a podcast this evening anyway. Do you want to join in?
And yep, I don't mind. I listen to your podcast regularly. I heard the last one. Where Julian only got 40% into the book.
Yeah, we just recalled that. Like, we just did that 2 days ago or something, so you're all caught up. The last one that I listened to of your one was... Actually, I don't have it. I'm going to get to the June one. I'm definitely going to do the June ones. How many of the June podcasts? You split it up into like...
There's two finished. I'm not sure that there's two out.
There's only one released. I haven't listened to the one that's released. Maybe I'll just save them all up and then listen to them all back to back.
I think that's the way to go if you like Dune, right?
Yeah, maybe. I listened to the Dying Earth one was probably the last podcast. Oh, that's a few podcasts ago. That was back in April. I've got The Glory Road by Robert A. Heinlein. That was the last one. When did that come out? Yesterday. Yeah.
Not listening to that one yet. That was yesterday's. And that's a funny episode because it's only me and Paul.
Oh, okay.
And for the first hour, we're both complaining about how bad the book is and also how good the book is. And then Paul says something like, I don't think that you should hand any young people this, you know, this book or any Heinlein book because it's so problematic. And I'm like, I go into full autoimmune disorder mode.
Really?
and start saying, no, everybody should be handed, you know, despite all the horrible stuff, because Heinlein's so important.
Yeah, but it is a bit problematic. It really is.
Absolutely is problematic, but it is so important. So it's a funny episode because when it becomes normal and then suddenly I go crazy.
Yeah, all right, I'll get to it. Right, so the book that I'm talking about today is a book which, this is the thing I always say, I review every single science fiction book that I read, and sometimes they're fantasy books and sometimes they're weird, and this is by William Gibson, Pattern Recognition. It says here on Goodreads, Blue Ant number one. I haven't checked if there's any other books to read this, and I listened to it because I listened to the Incomparable podcast. They have these book clubs, and I think one of them was sort of like, hey, books that you should read. I don't even know, can't remember which episode it was, but two people recommended Pattern Recognition by William Gibson as some of the best William Gibson writing. Have you read William Gibson, like Neuromancer and stuff? I'm sure.
Yeah, and I like Virtual Light, and actually I was thinking about reading this one, but... And I've heard bits of it, like, on BBC Radio, and I love his writing.
Yeah.
You know, his sentence-by-sentence writing is amazing.
Yeah.
He's just got that style that is so awesome.
This is the best writing of his.
I wouldn't say no to reading this one, you know.
It is definitely the best writing of his that I've read, having read Neuromancer, and I think, like, the first quarter of Virtual Light, but Virtual Light didn't get into me because it felt really dated for some reason. I'm not sure. I mean, it's not like Neuromancer isn't dated, but there are some definitely dated feelings to it, and it's, I think with Cyberpunk, it grows old so quickly in that way that it doesn't feel new anymore so quickly. Does that make sense? Like, And that's kind of the case here, although this isn't a... and this is the thing, actually, let's just get straight into it. I made some notes here. Like, what is the genre of a book, which I thought going in was science fiction, because it was like, you know, it's William Gibson. I thought it could be science fiction or cyberpunk or something. I was kind of expecting that going into this book. And then I read it, and it's not really that either. It's not cyberpunk. Or if it is cyberpunk, because it's set... so long ago that today's cyber and today's punk is way more like just the world that we're living in now is way more cyberpunk than a book set when this book is. So yeah, it's a really weird one that I kept expecting like a science fictional twist partway through to go, oh, this is what makes this book science fiction, or this is what makes this like really good cyberpunk, or this is what makes it cyberpunk. But that never actually came along. Which is weird. I just wasn't expecting that. So it's
can
one
I,
of these...
Can I guess the premise? Because
I
that's what I heard about this book, and I think it's three books or something like that, right? That
I never heard of this.
Science fiction, but it's still William Gibson.
Yeah.
And I think the main character who also shares the name from the main book he's known for, Neuromancer, yeah. Case, yeah. I guess, is probably pronounced the same way.
It's pronounced the same way, spelled differently. Yeah.
Right. So she her thing, I think, is she has an allergy to, is it brands?
Well, yeah, it's logos and trademarks is what she, it's not so much brands, but yeah.
Yeah, and I have the same thing. That's one of the reasons I'm kind of I don't think I've ever worn a shirt with a logo on it, you know, like a swoosh or even an Under Armour or anything like that.
Yeah.
Because I had negative experiences with it in high school and junior high school and all that, but also just thinking of, like, every time I see somebody wearing that thing, I read whatever it's on there, and that influences my opinion about that person.
Yeah.
And even, like, around my house, I've got, like, I want to say Kleenex box, because Kleenex is the name of the brand, right?
Yeah, but the brand has become it. Yeah.
It's indeed. So I have a cover over my Kleenex box, so I don't have to see the brand on it. So I feel like I'm kind of in sync with the superpowered main character.
Well,
this book
is her superpower. Her superpower is that she's so dialed into this. She's one of these cool seekers. So she dials into logos and brands and all these, like, cool things which don't have brands on them yet and don't have logos on them yet. And she finds those, you know, because she finds things appealing, not despite their logos or despite their branding, but, you know, in the absence of it. And she's also like this is Case Pollard, this is the main character. She also is a consultant, so if she can look at a logo or a trademark or a design of some kind and she doesn't have a negative reaction to it, they know it's a good logo. So she'll come in and just look at them and go yes or no, and that's it. And then they go, right, thank you very much for your consultation, we'll work on this and we'll get back to you in a few days time when we've got a new one. And that's actually a side of the book which isn't explored that much, but it's if you're gonna have a character quirk, if you're gonna have like a quirky thing just to go with a character, it's a really good quirk. I've not read it in that way. So if you want, because it's also like it's a superpower to be able to know if a logo is going to be an amazing logo and get it work really well. Mm-hmm. But also it's the kryptonite as well, that like the way to put her out of action is to show her a logo that she's going to have a really bad reaction to.
Right, like Times Square or Leicester Square.
Leicester Square. It's actually strange because in the book she goes around different places and she goes to Tokyo and she's actually saying, oh yeah, in this one place outside this one train station in Tokyo, there's going to be loads and loads and loads and loads of logos. But because it's all in like Japanese logos, or it's all in what's the alphabet, the kanji alphabet? I'm not sure what the different alphabets they are. It doesn't affect her in the same way. But it's much more about like the Michelin Man is her main boogeyman, that if she sees a picture of the Michelin Man, she kind of freaks out and things. So it's a fun one.
How much do you think you've read the book? So how much do you think that this is William Gibson's life?
It feels, I don't know, I'm not sure if that's him or not, but you do get the feeling that quite a few of these like very influential computer people turn out they don't actually use computers and things, or they're kind of shut off, a bit like reclusive. I'm not saying that's what William Gibson is, but yeah, there are some kind of like extreme extreme tendencies, like the same kind of thing that you have, like you can't look at logos or you read into logos more than the people who are displaying the logos think. Yeah, maybe it is partly him. I just don't know him well enough as an author or a writer to know that kind of thing. But Case Pollard, cool woman, 32 or whatever she is. She always wears black because she doesn't want any labels on it or something like that. I'm totally the same. Like, I can't wear a t-shirt with logos on it. That sometimes I'll wear a t-shirt. I got one with a Juliana got me one with a logo from a a podcast I listen to, and there's a one or two other t-shirts that I've ever worn with any kind of design or picture or logo on the front, but otherwise I very much plain t-shirts or like a shirt without any things on there, because I can't, like you say, I'm maybe not as extreme as you, that I don't mind a logo or a Kleenex logo in the house, but on my t-shirts or my shirts I can't do like branded stuff. I even felt bad once when I was wearing some sweatbands, and the sweatbands had like the Under Armour logo on them, and so I wore them in. I always wear them inside out because the logo for me is a bit too, it's too prominent to see that on me all the time. So yeah, I guess I have a little bit of that.
The
on
socks
me too.
I'm wearing are inside out right now
because of the logo. They have little. Yeah, all right. Yeah. So we're kind of similar. And once I was actually wearing like a t-shirt, which was like a Nike t-shirt. No, it was an Adidas, so it has three stripes, and it was like a tennis t-shirt that I use for that I wear for juggling in. And then the shorts that I had were these swim shorts, which were also Adidas, and then the shoes I was wearing were also Adidas. Completely randomly, it's just those were some things, but they were all, I was wearing them all at the same time, and they all had these three stripes on them, and I felt really weird to be wearing, like, mm-hmm. I felt like a professional sports person who had like a sponsorship deal with one of the companies, and I was and it was freaking me out a little bit going on. And so also with juggling conventions, because I'm invited to lots of them, I often get given, or I've been given many juggling t-shirts, and I never wear them because and everyone at juggling conventions and festivals wears juggling festival t-shirts from previous, it's just not what everybody wears, but I've never been able to bring myself to wear a juggling t-shirt, or not in the last 18 years or something, have I gone to a juggling event wearing a juggling t-shirt of a different event. I can't cope with it. And if someone gives me a t-shirt and says, oh, could you wear this? And I'll put it on. And when I see a photo of me with that t-shirt on, I'm like, oh, how could I be wearing a t-shirt with a juggling convention design on it? Yes. Yeah, so I think maybe you and me have this tendency, especially with our personal clothes, like wearing socks inside out. I don't do that, but then I don't have any socks with logos on them. So maybe that's it.
Well, you can also wear them that way just because the seams are on the outside, and it makes it feel better as well.
Yeah, I like the inside socks, but that's everything. Anyway, so I made a note before. I made a note while flicking through the book. When is this book set? Because I often, especially with read this as an ebook, and often you'll press the Kindle, you'll open the ebook, and it just starts you chapter one, page one straight away. So you don't see all of dedicated this person, published at this time, here's the front cover, that's all skipped over. So I never actually looked this book up when it was written and when it was published. So as I was starting reading it, there was sort of like this technology kept coming up. For example, she gets given this computer, and it's an iBook. So what kind of time is an iBook out? And it wasn't like, now you just say a laptop, but there it was sort of like the cool thing was an iBook. So it's sort of like iBook, okay, well that's before there was MacBooks or MacBook Pros or whatever you have these days. So it's an iBook, and she was using Google search, but then she said she's opened up Hotmail, and I'm like, okay, so it's Hotmail, not Gmail, and talking about sharing videos online, so it's obviously pre-YouTube. And I was thinking, oh, this feels like mid-dot-com bubble bursting kind of time. So I was thinking, oh, maybe about 2000, 2001, because it was kind of feeling around about that time. So that was one of those things that, like, as I was reading it through, I was kind of getting closer and closer to what time this is based. And because there's actually no speculative technology at all, there's no science fictional elements in the technology at all. It's very much, okay, now she logs in here and she opens up this forum, and I'm like, oh, this is forums even before Facebook and all that kind of stuff. And it really brought back nostalgia of the internet in about 2000 2001. And then actually it references 2000, like 9/11 2001, mm-hmm. And so it was a few years after that, but it was kind of a nostalgia hit reading a book which was so focused on the life on the internet in the year, well, I guess in this case, like 2002, mm-hmm. It was said. Have you noticed that in science fiction books, or is that dates it so closely?
The MacGuffin in Neuromancer is somebody stole 3 megabytes of RAM.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Boy, But that
was written in 1982 or something like that. I don't know, 1983.
Yeah.
But is based in, you know, 2020, I don't know, like years and years later. Yeah. But this was obviously written in 2002 and based in 2002. I mean, it's right there. It's like, it's so close. Like, all the technology is so on the nose for what's going on in the story. And it's always one of those things. She got out the laptop. She connected the thing. She did that. We were just talking about this in the last podcast, me and Juliana, sort of like, what's it like to read a science fiction book if it was based around using an iPhone in 2008 or whatever? So, like, and then she opened up this. She pressed the... press the capacitive touch screen, all that kind of stuff, or whatever it is. So
that was a good little sequence where I texted her, right?
Yeah. That was me just reading someone else's review of the book. But yeah, in this book, there isn't like, oh, I just texted her. It's sort of like, I opened up the iBook, I connected it to the phone, I started up tethering.
It's very fetishistic.
Yeah, it is. It is very, very much so. It's really dated as well. And like, oh, we're arranging a flight for you. I'll come round and deliver the tickets. And I'm like, oh, yeah, it used to be that you would have to like print out tickets. They would have to be like official tickets from an official travel agency. And someone would have to, you'd have to go to the travel agency and pick it up. And they'd be, you know, stamped and signed. And when you got to the airport, you'd do that. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on in the book. So yeah, super dated, but very nostalgic for me, because 2000 was when I was really getting into doing things online myself and having an online presence around about then. So, I mean, I was on the internet years before that, but that was when, you know, when you, before social media, but you know, Yahoo chat was my main social media at that time, I guess. It's a weird one. Yeah.
You can browse. You can browse too.
Browse. Yeah. Nobody surfs the internet anymore. When I was, you know, in 1997 or 1996, surfing the internet was a thing. Like, nobody ever does that. You just Google search now, go to it, or just type in what you want, or just use an app or something like that. Nobody just goes, oh, where does this go to? What's a web ring? Yeah. Were you ever on a web ring?
I didn't have a website at the time, but I definitely went around web rings. Yeah. Mostly what I remember is I'd, you know, you have to share the computer, share the internet connection. So I go up to the website that I want and I just start printing.
Yeah.
You know, print a bunch of stuff, take it away, read it. And then,
I did that as well.
Put it back in the printer after you flip it over.
At college, when I went to college and I discovered there was juggling stuff on the internet, I pretty much went through and printed out every single help file and every single essay and every single bit of text on the internet. No, what was it called? The Juggling Information Service, which still exists this day for various, patent reasons.
There's no video back then.
No, right? There was like one animated GIF of some like thing juggling.
Yeah.
That's how I became a popular juggler, was by putting videos up online in like 2000. And at one point I was having, you know, hundreds and hundreds of downloads of my videos per day, just because there was only
you were the juggling on the internet.
Yeah, well, not quite, but there was like four other people who had ever put juggling video, like lots of juggling videos of themselves online, and that's how I became one of the most famous jugglers in 2001. Anyway,
it's funny, and now that you mention it, my website is from 2003.
What's that?
So
SF
it's
Audio.
Right? Yeah, that's when we started it. So yeah. That's I mean, we didn't have any video, we didn't have any audio back then.
No.
It was basically a tiny little logo and, you know, a little post. And
so a lot
maybe
of this,
a tiny little, yeah, picture, 150 pixels high, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the reason I want to say about that with videos and sharing videos is because that's what this book is about. Part of it is about the main mystery of this story is someone is releasing snippets of video onto the internet, and it's video, and it's like movie quality video, and people download it, and it's sort of like there's 100 different sections, 130 different sections of this video, and people don't know if it's in the right order or not, and people are like editing together these, you know, these 10 second or 20 second video clips together and wondering like, is it going to be a full movie? And who is creating this video? It has to be someone with lots of production stuff or lots of money, because it's like Hollywood quality movie, but it doesn't feel like that at all. And it feels so quaint, for the idea being that an exciting thing on the internet is somebody releasing video onto the internet. And that's the big thing of this book. Who's releasing video clips onto the internet? And it's so amazing. Like I say, it's so much before YouTube that now anyone is just like, you know, people are uploading, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of hours worth of video to YouTube every second or something. I don't even know what the statistics are now. Yeah. But this is what this book is about. Someone is releasing videos on the internet, and there's this entire forums around it and entire subcultures coming along, and someone comes along and goes, right, this is the next new cool thing. Track down who's doing this video thing so we can glom onto this. And it's so hilarious, but like in 2001, sharing videos online was really difficult. Like, well, not really difficult, but it's, you know, to do it in a proper published video
way.
Yeah,
it just didn't really happen.
No.
I mean, anybody, because who could download it, right?
Yeah, like to download a video then, I mean, I remember like going, oh, just like an MP3 would be like a, you know, like a 20-minute download for like 1 megabyte of MP3 in like the shittiest quality. The way that I managed to share so many videos without running out of bandwidth or having to pay for bandwidth, because so many people were like, wow, it's so difficult. If you were an administrator of a Yahoo email group, you got given some, you know, a certain amount of, like, data storage. And So I was the administrator of four different Yahoo email groups or messaging groups or whatever it was. And you could actually make it.
I was one of those as well, actually.
Yeah.
Although I didn't use it for that. I just uploaded some pictures.
Yeah, so you could upload pictures. But in this case, I uploaded all the videos and then could just link to them from my website. And I was like, why isn't everyone doing this? And that's the reason why I think so many people were downloading my videos. Actually, to be honest, back then I was probably getting more views per day than I do now on my YouTube videos.
And a much bigger percentage of the internet.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, of all the people who wanted to download juggling videos, like, nobody would want to download and watch juggling videos without getting to my videos or whatever. And that's, again, one of the reasons why I'm a professional juggler now, is because I became a well-known juggler back then, I guess. So yeah, so that's the main mystery. Case Pollard is like, track down who can find, like, who is this, who's releasing these videos. And I was thinking, all right, this is now the science fictional part. It's going to be like an artificial intelligence, because that's kind of hinted at. There's this guy, this Russian guy, who's putting together this installation, which is lots of nodes in a band. I was like, oh, that's it. People saying, well, is it of real people or is it of real places? We're not quite sure. I was like, oh, this is going to be it. We're actually looking at the dreams of an arising artificial intelligence, machine intelligence, which is the internet. And I'm thinking, this is perfect for 2002. Turns out it's not that at all. It's just some, you know, something else. I don't need to spoil it, but it's just not that. And in the end, it's just sort of like, oh, rich people making some videos. And there's more to it than that. But it felt really disappointing that by the end of this big thing that I thought, this is the thing that's going to put the science fictional twist on. In the end, it's going to be, you know, some emergent property of the internet, of people sharing stuff on the internet, is that, you know, it creates video. No, not that either. I actually just looked up now on this what shelves people have put this onto Goodreads. I think this is good science fiction. 929 people have called it science fiction. Sci-fi, another 763 people have put it on their sci-fi shelf. There's mystery.
So what would you say?
It's here, 109 people call it a thriller. If it is a thriller, it's the most unthrilling thriller, because there's never any, it doesn't feel like there's any danger in it, because like the main thing is like, who's making this video? And it's never like, oh, this is life threatening. And there is a bit of like spookiness with people like stalking people or bugging people in their home or whatever. So there is a little bit of thrilliness to it. What else have people done here? Espionage. It is espionage. There's a bit of espionage in there, like business espionage. What else? Intrigue. Business intrigue. 27 people call it an intrigue book. Investigators, private investigators. Yeah, so it's this mix of like, I don't know, it's sort of like, it isn't speculative fiction, because it is so, the technology is so close and the world is so close to 2002, 2003 internet stuff. So it turns out, not really science fiction. Certainly not cyberpunk. Like I say, the most cyberpunkish technology in the world in 2003 is nothing compared to just normal everyday life in 2018. Like, there's very little cyberpunkishness. There's you know, the cyber side or the punk side is nothing. You know, there's just nothing in it which feels even remotely exciting. You know, when you were saying before about fetishistic look at what technology is, it's so bland. Not even bland, it's just so naive, banal. I don't even know what to say about it, because it's like, it's all that kind of thing. It's just like, yeah, like in everyone's pocket, we have computers and stuff more powerful than this. The technology that makes the videos. So I'm like, yeah, everyone just has that. It's like built into Instagram now. Anyone can do special effects with Snapchat filters, which like are more impressive than that's being talked about in this book. So it's really crazy to read a book, which even at the time, it seemed too real to be cyberpunk, and now it isn't even cyberpunk. It's not even slightly speculative, I guess. You know, there's nobody with a hard drive in their head or a you know, a hand which has a, you know, a key in it or a camera in their eye or whatever. There's none of that at all. Like, the, you know, the old science fiction tropes. Yeah. None of the cyberpunk science fictiony tropes in there.
Does it feel science fiction? That's the
The thing. It doesn't even feel that. There's none of the tropes. The only thing that made me...
Yeah.
Like, I could have read this book, and I guess I could have told you it was by William Gibson. Like, if you had said, oh, this is written by a famous science fiction or cyberpunk author, who would it be? I'd be, oh, this is definitely William Gibson. But you could give this book to someone. Don't tell them that lots of people have put it on their science fiction bookshelf in, you know, like called it science fiction fantasy or whatever, you know, in that genre. Because there just isn't any of that in it. Again, I thought the twist coming along would be that, but it isn't at all. So I've talked a lot about what it isn't, but what it is actually really good. I actually really enjoyed it because it's the writing is really good. And because it wasn't like Virtual Light, where the datedness kind of got in the way of that. And it wasn't like Neuromancer, where, you know, you're so kind of like caught up in the dystopian cyberpunkness of it, where you're trying to work through a story, which isn't very good. But, you know, it's well written. I'm just saying, I'm not a huge fan. I'm a huge fan of the writing in, like you say, the sentence-by-sentence, paragraph-by-paragraph, you know, writing in Neuromancer, I think is really great. But overall, I think the cyberpunk story behind it isn't that satisfying to me. I didn't enjoy it that much. Overall, a good book.
It's a traditional heist novel.
What's that? A heist novel.
It's a traditional heist novel.
As a traditional heist novel, I don't think it stands up that great as a heist novel. I know what he's going for, but I found it slightly disappointing as a heist novel. But again, it's fine. But this is in its own terms, this is a book about somebody using the internet and who's been given a lot of money, like unlimited funds to do what they want. So they go jet setting around the world, and all of that is fine. All of that is fun. The story is fine. I mean, not very complex, and it wasn't that satisfying at the end, but the actual story of, like, okay, what's it like to be someone from New York in London? And a lot of the book is set in London, and she calls it the mirror world, like the mirror land or something like that. So everything looks kind of familiar, but is like just twisted in a way. And there's lots of that. And then when she goes to Tokyo, there's lots of stuff which is about, oh, Tokyo is the same in some ways, but very twisted. And then goes to Moscow. And that's really twisted. That's like twisted another way. And I really like the idea of somebody who is like constantly jet lagged from going around the world, kind of always being a bit on edge of what it's, you know, what it's like to be in this new city. And that's what this book is about more than anything. It's about someone's just experience of the world, going into these weird situations and going to different hotels and just going out shopping and that kind of stuff. I found really fascinating. Again, not because it's science fictional.
It's just stuff that you do too, right? You're always jet lagged around the world and going from city to city.
And I think that's why I connected with this, because I do go to places and I do go to like I'll go to like three different cities in three days in France or Italy or something. And each one of them is twisted slightly, and you really do get a feeling for that. And you know, I have been to New York, and New York is like a weird version of, you know, parts of Berlin you can find in New York, but it's weird. And parts of London you'll find in New York, and parts of New York you'll find in London. So all these different things, they are twisted images of themselves. But so there are a lot of great writing. Let me actually find. I'm gonna actually just look on the Kindle app, because I did put some notes in here. Not notes. What do you call it? Highlights. Let's have a look. The Kindle app is a bit weird. Here we go. So there's this one thing that where she signs up to something, she gets given a credit card. She goes, Case puts the card face down on the trestle table and signs its virgin back. Something seems to clunk heavily at the rear of her ethical universe. And I'm like, that is really good. She's signed up for a job that she knows is a bit wrong. She knows this isn't the right thing to do. But by signing her name on the back of her credit card, it's sort of like something clunks in her ethical universe. That kind of... that kind of writing is sort of like, you know what, I really like those turns of phrases, and this book is just full of them. And that's, like I say, sentence by sentence, the writing is just amazing. Like, every third sentence has got some interesting twist on how to look at the world, and I'm like, oh, that's really interesting.
That's how he talks too.
Oh, really?
Gibson, right? Yeah, when you listen to him talk, he's always Case Pollard. I am pretty sure. It's just that fetishizing and the fact that he's flying all over the world and people want to talk to him.
Yeah, yeah.
What does he really have to sell? Right. The only thing he has to sell is his viewpoint on reality.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, this is what happens with stand-up comedians. What happens is that they'll get to a certain level and they've been doing comedy about their own life. And it's interesting because they have a different life than everybody else, because they come from an interesting job. Maybe they used to be a doctor or they used to be whatever. And then when they get successful as a stand-up comedian, all their stand-up comedy becomes about life on the road as a stand-up comedian. And there's sort of like road stories in that. And I was flying here and I was taking the train there and I was driving here and stuff like that. And suddenly all of the material seems to then go around that. And that's what this book feels like. It feels like, oh, I'm just going around and I've been given all this money. I've got this money and I can spend it on whatever I want. Money is definitely a superpower in this book, like having unlimited money. And that's what, I mean, that's what James Bond has. He always has a stash of money somewhere. And he's just like, let's go. And he needs to go there, change his name.
He's not playing with his own money. He's playing with the British government's money, right? So,
and that's kind of
he can afford to
lose
tons at the casino.
And that's what this book is about. It's suddenly like someone who's gone, right, now you have unlimited funds. What do you need to do? Oh, I need to fly to Tokyo. Great. And when you're in Tokyo, I need to get a new jacket. Great. And a haircut. Great. And it's just like all this stuff. And she kept going, how far can I push this? Spending other people's money. And I just want to get myself an interesting, new pair of shoes or an interesting bag that doesn't have a logo on it or something like that. And it's weird to be interested about somebody, going shopping in Tokyo. But for some reason, I was fascinated by all that kind of stuff.
I think part of it is it being a period piece. If you had read it at the time, it wouldn't be as fascinating. I love reading the old Raymond Chandler set in a very particular year.
Yeah.
Right. In a very particular city. And it has a story, a mystery, something and a character with a viewpoint. This is very important. A character with some sort of view on reality, not just a Mary Sue or, a detective. It has to be somebody who has some sort of idea as to how the world should be, if not how it is.
Yeah.
And then looking at it like that, it becomes much more interesting than it would be if you're just reading it at the time.
Yeah. I think because this is a period piece, I just noticed another thing that here. They're saying the new Russians are into transparency. Companies that actually have books pay taxes. They figured out that you can make even more money that way. It's no accident that Putin always describes himself as a lawyer. He is. And I was like, oh, Putin was around in 2002.
Sure.
And he still is. And it's one of those things you go, oh, this is a period piece. But actually, yeah, it's still the same guys. And there's, Russian mob people and business people in this book as well. I like this line as well. They say, now we say that everything Lenin taught us of communism was false and everything he taught us of capitalism true, which I think is quite a fun little saying. There's quite a few little things there. I reckon he'd either been to Moscow or been somewhere like that and heard a lot of this stuff and was just like, oh, this is just going straight in the book.
He absolutely is using it. And that's why when this book came out, I was like, whoa, this is not science fiction.
Yeah.
Okay. I hope that's not the future trend, but it sort of is the future trend for him. I think he caught up with the period
the technology,
of time in
which
he was ahead of it when he was typing it on a typewriter, and then with the second book, third book, he's got a computer, he's up to speed, he's on the internet.
Mm.
It's very interesting. Douglas Adams did the same thing, right?
Yeah.
He starts with science fiction and then, nope, we're going to reality. Right?
Yeah, and he starts doing detective series and things.
A detective with no goal, right? Yeah. He just follows other people around because they're interesting.
Yeah.
And then he finds the story within the existence.
That's now a Netflix show. Juliana watched it. The what's it called?
Yeah, it's not awful.
Okay.
It's not awful.
Well, maybe I'll watch it sometime.
It's not the books.
So here's
the
thing. At the time, I think this would have felt more science fictional because lots of people wouldn't yet have had that experience with life on the internet and the interesting things that are happening to this person and the stories that come across with this person comes across on the internet is now just like so much of a daily way of life that I think now it feels less like a science fiction novel than it did at the time. Look at this. Literary Awards. Nominee for the Locus Award. Arthur C. Clarke Award nominee. British Science Fiction Association Award. And Mary Shelley Award for Outstanding Fictional Work. Like, that's all in 2004. Now, this book would just feel like maybe at most some kind of techno thriller, but it's certainly not cyberpunk. It's certainly not science fiction, which, again, not to take it away from the book. Again, I don't think the story is that strong and the central mystery doesn't feel dangerous enough for it to be a thriller. And I wasn't quite sure. Like, now it's really difficult to see why everybody is interested about somebody releasing videos on the internet. Like, it was really difficult for me to get my head around why this is a central thing. You know, but then I had to think back what I was doing in 2002, which was releasing videos on the internet. And I was like, oh, that was a thing back then. That was a difficult thing. And it's really difficult to get my brain back into that thing, that world. Like in here, in this book, there's all these things sort of like, oh, and they met someone and then they're going to meet someone and have sex with someone that they've met on the internet. So I'm like, yeah. And like even in 2002 I guess I was doing that, and yeah, I was, but like now it's sort of like I think over 50% of people who get married now met on online dating, like on OkCupid or whatever the services are now, you know, there's different things. Like, but my relationship now has been going longer than Tinder has existed. Me and Juliana, we met each other via OkCupid, and at the time in 2011 or something, OkCupid was the latest thing, and now that is so, like, OkCupid is so mainstream and Tinder is so mainstream that that's just the way that people, and in this book is going, oh, and he's a nerd and then they met for the first time, and I mean, it's not quite that blatant, you know, it's not quite as clear cut as that, but to have a long distance chatting relationship on the internet and then to meet someone for the first time, it's like a big thing. And now it's like, well, yeah, it's just life, isn't it, now to like chat with people long distance. And then I mean, you and I have known each other, what, like coming up 10 years now or something, and we've never actually met
in real life.
We've never been in the same country at the same time. Although, oh, yeah, actually, true. I probably, when I visited Canada, you were probably in Canada, but you know what I mean? Like, it's...
but you're on the wrong side.
Yeah, you were in Vancouver, and I was literally in Newfoundland, so, yeah, probably as far away from each other as we could possibly be and still be in the same country. Maybe in any country. Oh, no, Russia's probably...
Skype came into existence in 2003.
Yeah, exactly. August. This is the thing. Like, in the book, it's sort of like, oh, like, I mean, I mentioned this in the last podcast. It's so weird to read a book and they're like, and then long distance phone calls were no longer a thing. You could talk to anyone anywhere in the world for the same price. And we're like, yeah, free Skype. That's where we are now. Anyway.
It was revolutionary.
Yeah, it is crazy. And it's still what everybody uses to do podcasts and gaming. And, well, not gaming. Discord now is for gaming. Anyway, I don't think I've got much else to say about this book, except that don't read this book if you want a science fiction book. Don't read this book if you want a cyberpunk book. Don't read it if you want a particularly thrilling techno thriller or any technology in your techno thriller that isn't there. It's very much now a period piece of like, what was it like in 2001, 2002? Like, there's lots of like 9/11 is a huge event in this book for Case Pollard and her backstory with being in New York at that time. And these days, like, you don't even, that's not even mentioned in modern science fiction anymore. Like, there was a few books at the time where I was like, oh, this is the first post 9/11 science fiction book that I've seen come out. I can't remember them, what they were at the time. But when you read a book which was like, oh, this is mentioning 9/11, and it's only 2002 or 2003, so this is obviously pretty new and it feels like really current. And now it feels dated because that's hardly even mentioned anymore. Like, now the trope is to have someone coming back from the Iraq war for Afghanistan or something like that. It's, you know, it's mm-hmm. the... we're already into the oh failed war Vietnam stage that it was like in the 1980s or whatever.
Yep.
So we're already, yeah, the war in Afghanistan is in Iraq's coming up for what, like 17 years old now, that war.
Yep.
So it's it's a weird one. So I would suggest, Jesse, I think you would actually enjoy this book if you like his writing. But again, go in with the correct expectations, like I didn't, but I still happened to enjoy it. But all the time I was feeling like, should I be feeling disappointed that this isn't as science fictional as I expected, or even cyberpunk as cyberpunk that I expected? Now, I'm not even a big fan of cyberpunk.
Do you think you'll continue with the follow-ups?
Oh no,
I never
not at
do
all. No, no,
sequels.
I have to be really into a series to do a sequel, or it has to have all come out and I'm like excited for it. But this, I'm not excited at all. I don't need to. Yeah,
well, they're all out, I think.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. Like,
one was 2010. So.
Yeah, okay, but like I'm saying, like if there's a fantasy series, I'll always read the first book in a series just to give it a go. But yeah, to carry on, I've got to be really excited about it, or just leave it long enough and I'll be mildly curious and go, oh, I'll read second book. But I don't see myself doing that with this book. There's a lot of other William Gibson. Like, I will finish Virtual Light at some point, but I gave it a go in 2011 and never even got far enough to talk about it on the podcast.
Well, it's a real thing now. Augmented reality is a real thing, right?
Is it really a real thing?
I remember playing with those apps where it was Google Glasses, where you hold up the phone you can see, like, I mean, at that, I would totally want that.
Yeah, it's.
Phones are now.
Yeah,
they really are possibly. I mean, we are. Could have that very, very soon.
Yeah, I have an iPhone X, and it's got the dual camera, so it does all the depth sensing. I mean, I guess all new, top line cameras, iPhones, not iPhones, what I'm trying to say, all mobile phones, all Android phones, all iPhones, they all come with two cameras now, all the new Android phones that come out, the Samsungs and all those kind of things. And with the processor on this iPhone, the augmented reality stuff is spookily good. You know, when you put something on a wall or put something on a table, and there's the IKEA app where you just flick furniture and it just appears in the room, and you're like, oh, that's really cool. So I totally understand it, but I don't think there's that killer app that all, you know, phones, you know, all these different new technologies have it. Nobody's quite worked out what augmented reality is for yet.
The Google translation, right, on your phone. I can use that sometimes when I have to. And if you've got that plugged into your headphones and it's in your glasses and somebody's talking to you, you're going to be speaking your language, they're going to be speaking your language, and it's going to be the Star Wars universe where everybody except for, you know, one character doesn't understand Chewbacca.
Yeah.
And R2-D2 is the only one who doesn't have any translator into him, right?
Yeah, there's this thing called Word Lens, which was an app which I think Google bought. Google bought it and incorporated it into Translate, and it was just, you just pointed your camera at something, at any text, and if you had the two dictionaries, it would just translate those words into other words, and then use the same. Then use the same font and put it on. Yeah, I guess that's just built into Google Translate now.
If you've got like a can of pop and it's from China, you can hold your camera in front of it and it'll start doing the translation on the screen in real time in video. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. That's what Word Lens. That's what Google bought to put into the app. So I used the app Word Lens, and that was back in, you know, 2014 or something like that. So it's been around. I've used it for a while.
It hasn't got that killer technology. It's probably a piece of hardware rather than a piece of software.
But nobody wants to put Google Glass on. I wrote literally.
It's going
to
be something else.
I wrote literally three novels about exploring this myself. I just waiting to catch up with my own science fiction that I wrote. But
it'll be slightly wrong in the wrong way.
It's totally wrong. Like even now, my own fiction from 2008 is terribly dated. Like, yeah, it was 10 years ago I released that novel. Wow, yeah, so that's quite a way ago. Or 2009, whenever it was that I finished writing it. Okay, I said we were going to do like 20 minutes on this book because it wasn't science fiction. I didn't have a lot to say about it, but we've done 40 minutes. So let's wrap this up. Thanks for joining me on this podcast, and let's see if we can get PUBG working again and we can go on a shooty adventure. What do I normally say at this point? Oh, yeah, I'm going to rate this book. I'm going to rate it 3 stars. As a science fiction book, 1 star. But it's, if you don't go into it, if you got like right, correct your expectations, this is a solid 3-star book, I think. Because there's a lot of interesting writing, a lot of brand tourism and different cities that visited and things like that. And the whole concept of having jet lag is that you leave your soul behind. This is like the opening few paragraphs of the book, is that you leave your soul behind and you land in the city and it takes your soul like a few days to catch up with you. So there's a lot of like, yeah, my soul was like still only halfway across the Atlantic and then I was already organizing a flight to Tokyo or whatever it was. So yeah, lots of really great writing, really great imagery. But unfortunately a few of the characters that I thought were going to be playing big parts didn't. And then what I thought was going to be the mystery, the answer to the mystery isn't as interesting as the journey to get there, which is a bit of a pity. It turns out that money can be a superpower, and it can be the money is the question and the answer and how answer is found. And that's a little bit unsatisfying, but it is sort of like a wish fulfillment book of like, hey, I want to be James Bond and travel around the world where money is no object. So it's like, great, here's a book for you, which is fine. Anyway, 3 stars. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge. You can follow Jesse on Twitter. He is at SFF Audio, aren't you? Yes, you are.
Yep.
And you can follow him there, like I do, although I think I have you muted because you tweet a little bit too much for me to keep up. And check out the podcast, SFF Audio. Have you? You've must have talked about Neuromancer on your podcast, haven't you?
Oh yeah, we did a big show on Neuromancer years ago.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure you had. But you only do the books once. That's the problem. That's the problem. Oh, I should have. Maybe I didn't do it. I should publish because we did the War of the Worlds, didn't we? So I should actually put that in the feed. So I'm in my feed too. I should check. Sure. I should check if I put it in the feed. Yeah. So. All right, that's it for me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.